always record episode 16 with Andras Jones.
Andras is on the line. Andras Jones, Bill Klaus.
Hello, Bill.
Hello, Andras. How the hell are you?
I'm doing well. I hear I've been drawn down a similar sinkhole to one you've been working on. I found myself synchronistically transported to your side of the street, let's say.
Yeah, that's happening a lot lately, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been, I work as a bartender, and I got hired to work at a bar that has a big movie screen, and so we're looking at ways to do promotions, and I got this idea to do the Dark Side Wizard thing, but with different films and different records. So I've been putting those together. And then, of course, the week that I put those together, I start hearing about your work and realizing, oh yeah, this is just a different strain of sync films. But to me, it speaks to me so much more than sort of the high. I mean, not that I don't love the other highly edited things, but this long form. Dropping in a record, a classic record that you're really familiar with an iconic film that you're really familiar with, and seeing how they sync is just, it hits me on every level that I love. So I'm very curious to know more about your work.
Well, you know, I think, who was I having a discussion with about this the other day? About boiling it all back down to the storyteller. And that when a storyteller is doing their thing at its purest form, well, then you get to that pure story. So if you overlap different medias in which storytellers work, well, since they really, in their purest sense, are always telling the same story, it's just a matter of chronology, maybe at a certain point, that overlap is just inevitable. It just seems strange. Or if anything, I think that the media that has evolved in the last 150 years, along with the history that's evolved over the last 150 years, that because movies like The Wizard of Oz or 2001 lend themselves so well to music, I think lets us kind of understand just how compact the last 150 years really are. That if there was ever a moment in time when the storyteller got it right, or when the story just is so explicit and so compact, that this is the moment, this is the time. You know, the storyteller's trying to reach out and explain the same thing, and with this new technology, it's all just rushing out for the first time. So yeah, Kubrick and Roger Waters, I mean, they really draw a circle around them, and it's a real tight circle. So their expressions are going to be within that circle, and they're just going to completely resonate. And I think that, you know, David's work is, you know, completely incredible, and he's been at it for 10, 15 years, I think. So it's kind of interesting that I did not know that about yourself, that you were in the same kind of waters at the same time was actually...
You're in the same Roger Waters?
But no, that's fascinating, because I remember I read a blog post of yours about a year ago, and you said that you were a bartender, that you were about to do the Master Cleanse, and you were doing something else, and I was like, that's me. I was just finishing the Master Cleanse. I was a bartender, and you know, you were blogging about synchronicity, and so I guess we were entangled back then to a higher degree, and now it's all coming full circle.
Yeah, well, this is a totally new thing. I mean, this just came out of creating something for my bar. I mean, it's what I do anyway, is syncing with music, but usually it's music with my own life. I'm kind of curious, what are some of the album movie bullseyes? Like, I think they all work. I think almost anything would work if you're familiar with it and if you like it.
That's, I mean, really, I guess this is all art theory at a certain degree, right? Because if a lot of people agree that one thing is the bullseye, you know, like for years, they said the greatest movie ever made was Citizen Kane. And I had heard that as a child, and I just accepted it as smart people who know smart things and know good movies, that's the best movie ever made. And I just took it as gospel. You know, it was etched in stone. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s where I got to see Citizen Kane for the second or third time that it dawned on me why they might be saying this about that movie. But nowadays, I guess it's Vertigo is the best movie ever made.
Well, that's nonsense. People keep saying that. I just like that's to me, that's just complete nonsense. It's not even the best Hitchcock film. And it doesn't stand up in my mind, not even close to Citizen Kane in terms of like it's such a that's perfect for our time because it's such an apolitical, sociopathic little piece of Hitchcock's, you know, psychology, as opposed to Citizen Kane, which is a massive statement about America and history at that time. And it deals with, you know, it blurs the line between reality and fiction in ways that synchronistically kept showing up in Wells's life for the rest of his life. Every time someone says that to me, I have to go on a bit of a rant. Like, come on, pick Star Wars as the best film, not Vertigo. That's it's just an icky little film. Ugh. I mean, what?
And I think people are forgetting the wizardry that was Orson Welles at the age of 24.
Yeah.
The fact that he understood what the media was capable of, this new media of film, it was the quantum leap. You know, it was Sergeant Pepper's out of Revolver. I mean, he jumped the what was possible.
Wait,
and so everyone started
back up there. You would take Sergeant Pepper over Revolver?
I'm just saying.
I'm asking. It wasn't a challenge. This is a question. I mean,
I would take Revolver over Sergeant Pepper's.
Yeah,
but,
I think I would too.
What that album provided us was the ability to dream while awake and on audio tape, you know, or on vinyl. I mean, it was to capture the vision. I mean, the psychedelic bouquet of Sergeant Pepper's, like the cover even gets it. I mean, that everything about that piece of work is just it's genius. But do I go back to it on a daily basis? No, I don't. I'd much rather pull out Revolver and listen to that on a more regular basis. But
going to the Wells thing, Citizen Kane is like Revolver. And if he had been able to do The Magnificent Ambersons and Heart of Darkness and if he had had the success and the support that the Beatles had, his next films would have continued to explore that. And he does in Touch of Evil. He does try and do it. He just never had all we have from Orson Welles pretty much is his I Want to Hold Your Hand. And it's so perfect that it stands for the ages. You know, without him ever again getting that kind of, you know, that kind of access to resources. So all I'm saying is comparing the Beatles to Orson Welles, I get what you're saying. But as far as Alan, you can't really compare because Orson Welles didn't get to make multiple films.
Right.
He only got to make one.
I understand. I was sort of tangential question of. I think, you know, I'll go this way. This is a silly conversation, but I think that Revolver has better songs, but Sgt. Pepper is the better album. And maybe that's sort of where we're going is instead of, you know, Orson Welles understood the sort of long form epic that was possible. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah. Well, maybe Sgt. Pepper's really reinvented what could be understood as an album.
Yeah.
And that's what Wells did with Citizen Kane, and that's why it gets. If you're juggling four or five movies and you can't decide who's number one, I always go with the groundbreaker, the one who did something when there was really nothing else like it.
Yeah.
Because a copy of a copy of a copy, there's a million of those, and there might be one that shines through all of them and sort of is deserving of all the acclaim. But the person who did it without a copy, the person who reached out of the ether and brought it into physicality, I mean, that is the trick. That's how you get, you know, the crown to a certain extent. So I can't take that off of Wells' head at this moment and say that it's Hitchcock's Vertigo or really anything for that matter. And that's why I think maybe Kubrick gets a nod with 2001, because he definitely, with that movie, created something with, I mean, it wasn't until Star Wars that space visuals started to look real. And to this day, 2001 is the best looking space movie. I mean, it's not even close. So it's directors who were able to sort of reinvent or just invent what was possible. So I guess that was sort of.
Now, can I just let me just take it this way, because Andres, you asked him a question about what are the bullseyes. So it doesn't have to be this highbrow, high art, low art conversation, because, Bill, I know you do something regularly to this day where you're going to the movie theater and watching, you know, modern, poppy, let's call them lowbrow films, and you're watching them with headphones on. So you're doing this on a regular basis of trying, you know, seeing what, I mean, you watched John Carter of Mars with headphones on. You said you saw it three times, you still never actually heard the dialogue.
Yeah. You know, it goes back to, there was a thing McLuhan said about television, and that he said, television is more like illuminated manuscript. And manuscript is something you look at. Print is something you read. Well, it seems to me that film is just a larger extension of television, and that the visual is an illuminated manuscript. It's something that you look at. But I tend to get the feeling that with the audio and with the dialogue, you no longer really look at it like you would a manuscript. You're sort of, I don't know the word for it, but it's a completely different sensory perception mode. And
it's running to read visuals. It's almost like the ayahuasca of like hearing sound. Seeing sound. This is like seeing sound or reading vision.
Exactly, because you know how like when you're in a movie theater, there is a library quality to it, that if someone's talking or distracting you, why is it ruining your experience? It's because you're missing dialogue and you're not, and it's getting chopped up and you can't follow the movie. That there's a linear breakdown that causes confusion and annoys people to an extent to where, you know, it can be a very uncomfortable situation when someone is not following the rules, as it were. And with cell phones or with screaming kids, it can destroy the experience completely for those people. And so I'm thinking that's that sort of sensory reading the movie. Now, obviously, if you're listening to headphones, you have no problems with people talking. You have no problems with babies. There is no issue there. But really, the ultimate point of that is to appreciate what the film medium brings you and what the director's vision brings you. Can they tell a story just with the visuals? Or if they are a true storyteller, and if they're telling stories from a very pure and advanced sort of ability, then you shouldn't need dialogue to tell you what story it is. You already know the story. And so when I watched John Carter, it blew me away how transparent it was and how moving it was. And I've almost convinced myself I would not have gotten that experience out of that movie had I not approached it in the way that I did. I wouldn't have gotten bogged down with, wait, what are the name of those aliens and what planet are they from and what are they trying to do? And all that is completely removed. And I highly recommend it as an exercise for just sort of being able to extract more or get more out of your media nowadays. What's the movie with the guy who does the speech, who stutters and won an Academy Award?
King's Speech?
The King's Speech. I went and saw the King's Speech and listened to
Who's next?
No, Daydream Nation by Sonic Youth.
Oh, okay.
Why I did that, had no idea. I just wanted to mix it up and test that theory of, well, can you do this with anything? Can you do it with any movie, and can you do it with any album, and you can get something out of it? And to a certain extent, you do. There are resonances. You're still getting, you know, the visuals from the movie. You're still reinterpreting the music that you're listening to. You still are in a room full of strangers at a movie theater. But as far as on a scale of 1 to 10, how much I would recommend that arrangement, it would be very, very low. I mean, even myself, I kind of lost contact with the flow of everything I was, you know, putting together there. Whereas other movies, in other situations, it just doesn't stop. It just compounds and compounds and continues to deliver a very entertaining and very information-rich experience. So I guess to bring this all home is that it is worth the time to take anything and mix it together to see what you have. But I do believe certain combinations will speak to more people more broadly, regardless of where they're from, what their background is, and what they believe. And whatever that means, and whatever it is that what combinations work, I don't know. Why is it? Why is that? That's sort of the mystery.
Isn't it possible? Like I've been playing with is so the best experience I've had, I just did, and I'm new to this, but I just did one with The Who's Lifehouse and The Matrix. And are you familiar with The Who's Lifehouse?
Yeah, absolutely. That seems like a perfect thematically.
Absolutely. Right, because it predicts the internet, and so it, you know, it's all this machine music, and it goes with it, and it syncs up perfectly. But at the same time, it syncs up perfectly because I'm deeply intimate with that record, and like almost everybody else who's ever watched movies, I'm pretty intimate with that film. Like, you don't need to have the dialogue under it. When Morpheus holds out his hands, you know what he's saying. You know every beat. You know, may not know the exact dialogue, but if you intimately know the film and you intimately know the album, and of course, if they're thematically linked and both excellent pieces of work, which those both are, then those seem like the conditions for creating a great one. But part of that condition, like all sync, has to do with the context that we bring. Like, if no one had ever heard that record or seen The Matrix before and you watched that, I don't know if they would get this. Well, I know they wouldn't get the same thrill that I would. They might get a different one. And your experiments with the theaters, with going into theaters and watching films you haven't seen with records, I assume that you know, you know, is a great little sort of an experiment in how that plays out.
Yeah, because like a no-brainer is seeing the first time I ever did it was Harry Potter with Dark Side of the Moon. And you know, you have one movie that has a witch, this has a warlock. It's about magic. It was a perfect hunch to say, I think these works of art are going to be about the same thing. I don't know what the story is on the of the Harry Potter film. I think it was the sixth one, Order of the Phoenix or something like that. But I know this album well, and I actually didn't expect it to really keep my interest. I figured it would be a nice gimmick for about 20, 30 minutes, and then I was prepared to leave the movie theater. But I was compelled, like a good book, to just keep turning the pages. And that really is, I think, a perfect way to describe it when it's working, is that it's like a good book. You don't spend 20 minutes looking at it and kind of go, wait, what the fuck? Did I just, you know, turn 20 pages and I have no idea where I am? If it's a page turner and you just keep, you're not even turning pages, you're in the book. And so when it's really clicking and you're in there, the Harry Potter movie I first watched it with was 2.5 hours. I think that the album cycled through 3 or 4 times. And when the movie ended, it kind of surprised me. When it cut to the credits, I was thrown out of this place I was in, and I just sat there in my chair stunned. And the thing that kind of killed me about that experience was, okay, so I sat in this completely crowded theater on a Friday night. The credits hit, and I'm just blown away. I feel like I walked into a theater, a different person, and, you know, it might have been a day, it might have been 5 minutes, but almost confusion. It was just, I was so far into the experience of the movie with the music that I just sat in my chair almost exhausted at what I had experienced. So as I looked to my right, it seemed like 95% of everybody in the theater had already gotten up and had already shuffled into the aisles. It was like no one sat there in any kind of afterglow at what they had experienced. It was as if everyone knew, okay, movie's over, let's get over here, let's get to the aisle, let's get to the car, let's get to the thing. It's like they had already mentally vacated the theater. There was no self-reflection. There was no, we just sat here with, you know, 600 people and watched this film for two plus hours. Whoa, what an experience. They had already digested it and they were already off to go wherever it was they went. And it was just a bizarre kind of Animal Farm moment. It was just like programmed cattle. It was kind of disturbing.
Now, if I may, that's funny because Andras said one of the films he used was Dark Crystal, and that just happens to be like an absolute favorite of mine. And there's a sort of like making of the Dark Crystal that they filmed back then, and so has all these interviews with Frank Oz and Jim Henson, and it's really interesting little piece of film itself. But it's sort of towards the end, Frank Oz is talking about just that. He's saying like they spent so many years making this movie, and he's like, and you know, at some point he would go to the movie theater and he sees that experience. He sees that people go to a movie and then the movie ends and they step outside and go, okay, where do you want to go for dinner? And he's like, what the fuck? What the fuck? Like, didn't that do anything to you? Or like, don't you want to sit with that for a little while? Don't you want anything? He's like, I was trying to make a film where you would hopefully take it with you. You'd want to take it with you that, because he saw that as the big issue is no, and it's so funny because we hear all these people talking about like the media is brainwashing you, and you know, there is, again, there is propaganda, there's all this sort of stuff, but I think the propaganda only works in that respect if you're not processing it. Oh, okay, yeah, there's, you know, we fight bad guys, yeah, all right, let's go to dinner, you know, we go eat at the Cheesecake Factory and whatever it is. You know,
what a disgusting name for a restaurant. Where are you going to eat? The Cheesecake Factory. Right off the assembly line.
I like to bring it back because I have another question. So, because you're talking about playing the having the record loop. But what I've been trying to do is only use long form I've been trying to use only records that can fill up the whole thing with maybe like with Lifehouse because I'm familiar with it. I'll put on like extra material that I know that exists, like a live version of a song and a Pete Townsend demo, and like so it fills out. Or I just did Do the Right Thing with Prince's Sign of the Times, and it.
Well, I like that. That sounds good.
That lines up perfectly, except actually that one lines up perfectly. That one is just it's the movie's just as long as the album.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's good.
I just did Once Upon a Time. I'm doing Once Upon a Time in the West with Sandinista, but that requires adding two or three live Clash tracks at the end from that album so that it fills out. I don't know, maybe it's just the OCD in me, but the idea of like just sort of having like of letting the album loop and then not like sort of that the film has a completion, but the record doesn't have a completion because it ends in the middle of the second or third time through. Something about that just offends me aesthetically. But
I follow that, and I think that it's, you know, better or worse, it doesn't matter. It, like you said, you're just looking for that zone where you get into that flipping pages mode. But
right.
What I appreciate about the looping of the album is just the fractal sort of hypercube four-dimensional kind of thing is that it never lets you forget that it's just a story within a story within a story, that you're always circling down or spiraling up. So when it really is working, like, let's say, Dark Side of the Moon through 2001, it's very curious how certain moments echo through that record to where certain songs, when they play the first time, when they play the second time or the third time, you take those sequences and they seem to then align themselves fractally. And it adds a different dimension to what you've got there. Now, that probably holds up to repeat viewings, and that's really for the criminally insane who who log in 8 or 9 viewings of 2001 with Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, you got to be in a real special place to sit down and make that your calling.
I don't know, man. I could watch this Matrix film. Like, I can watch it over and over. I mean, it's a record that I've listened to over and over again. I think that's part of what's great, is if you love the record and you like the movie, then you can. I don't think, and I think even like someone who's not super synced out, if you picked the right record and the right movie, they'd want to watch it 5 or 6 times too.
Well, let's get to the little elephant in the room, though, about all this. You smoke pot when you do it, right?
Of course.
Well, of course.
But you might as well say. But you might as well say, you know, that, you know, say that about breakfast.
Well, I don't eat breakfast.
But I mean, it is. How do you address? Is that even a stigma anymore? Because you remember what's the Dave Chappelle movie where
Pootie Tang?
Where he sells the pot and there's a great scene where he's like, "Have you seen it on weed?
Half baked, yeah.
Half baked. Oh man, you get it. But have you tried it on weed?" And that was a very pretty popular catchphrase amongst the people I knew. Because I was very guilty of that. It became a part of my identity that I just always had this, you know, I could see a movie and think I knew it and then smoke pot. And I was still trying to figure out what that whole equation meant, why that formula is such an integral part of the formula.
Well, now, I mean, I'm not 100% sure that it is, because I mean, certainly there are those of the people who, I think that there are people who are drawn to sync are going to be drawn to pot, just like people who are drawn to making money are going to be drawn to caffeine. Just like people who are drawn to going out and hooking up, getting laid, or into alcohol, and people who are into dancing all night or into ecstasy. What you're into determines what, you know, what stimulants you use for that. But what I think is, but I think with all of those things, if you take out the drug, the experience has the resonance of the drug. So I think that sync has the effect on people that sort of mind expanding drugs like marijuana or, you know, the psychedelic realm, that it opens, that it brings that experience to people without the drug. Just like you could dance all night without ecstasy and you would get yourself to a heightened state. Or you could go out and meet someone cool, totally sober in a bar and have the experience of that alcohol would give you of lowered inhibitions that would, you know, that would facilitate a connection.
And I agree with that. I agree with that completely. But for me, I would just say that marijuana is the training wheels on the bicycle that is film/music sync. So I would say right now, I don't need to smoke pot to put on an album and a movie. I've gone to a movie theater without smoking pot and listen to music and watch the movie, and I've done it with pot. Is it better with pot? Always. It just always is. There's just, it's stepping into the real party. But I do have enough sort of skills or whatever it is to do it without the substance, because I can speak the language now. I know what to look for. I know what I'm kind of structuring. I'm part of the process. But I wouldn't have been drawn into it without those training wheels. I just don't think that it would have occurred. Now, I don't think that there... I truly believe that there are individuals who never need to smoke pot and they just live like that. I think someone like Frank Zappa is probably one of the perfect examples.
So funny,
that he is just one of the quintessential artists. He might be the future or he might be the past, but Frank Zappa is the Frank Zappa. So I just think that if I were going to give somebody, let's say, The Wizard of Oz and Dark Side of the Moon and say, hey, sit down and watch this, I would also roll one with it. You know, it would just come as a package. I mean, it would be sold at Walmart like that.
You get no argument from me, and I don't even think that that's, I mean, I just think that it all makes sense. It makes sense that it's stigmatized. It makes sense why it's stigmatized. It makes sense why it works. And it makes sense why those laws are weakening every day.
So, I think what really drew me to pop was, I mean, I was always such a music fan all my life. And then there was something about that you said, have you listened to it on weed? I mean, that when I saw that movie, when I saw Half Baked, that was the scene that I really resonated with as well, because it's like one of my favorite things to do would be just smoke some weed and listen to some music, and it could be an album that you would heard a million times before, so of course you loved it sober. But then suddenly, like, oh my god, I didn't notice that, like, really subtle oboe in the background, that's beautiful, you know, or something like that, where you're like, you're noticing little elements of the music that of course you had heard as the forest, but you never saw the individual trees, or you never really appreciated all the little elements that went into it, or whatever it is. I mean, I remember I had, I almost had a Lifehouse moment was actually The Association. I don't know if you know The Association, a song called Never My Love. It's not...
Yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah, great song. Not the greatest band ever, but a great song. And one night, early on in my pot experiences, I smoked some weed and I heard that song. And you know that sort of harmony about like three quarters of the way through the song where it just sort of like goes on?
Yeah.
I just got lost in that and I thought I was having like an out-of-body experience. Like it was just like, holy shit. Like you said, I think this is the kind of thing where it allows you to pay attention or see the perceive the media. Not it should never be an excuse to for something bad. Like we've all done it, you know. Here's a really bad movie, and it would be terrible, or a song where it would be terrible otherwise. And you smoke some weed, and it's like, oh, that's kind of fun. I mean, that happens
to you, but I think that just I had that experience more when I was younger. Now. Pot just you know these the critic of eventually the critical mind
oh well that's like, funny that's fun. You see what I was gonna say is I actually have never had that experience. I get more critical because I'm paying more attention, so I was gonna say is, but I've heard so many people say like, oh well, of course it's a bad movie, but just smoke some weed, it's funny. And I'm like, no, this is worse because now I see every facet of how bad it is.
No, I'm right with you on that.
Yeah, I'd agree on that. I've never understood, like, oh, it's just shitty. It's terrible. It's awful. But smoke some weed, and, it's a good time. And that's a shitty formula. I'd like to give a little bit more respect to the plant and why it's on the surface of our planet.
Right.
I don't want it to make, an episode of – I got, season two of Martin, which can be fine, every now and then. But I ain't going to sit down and watch, 2.5 hours of Martin – and smoke weed to make it funny.
Actually, I don't even think it works that I don't think it's a great thing for film. I think it's a great thing for music, and that's why it goes well with this format. I mean, I'll still, you know, I'll smoke some pot before I watch a movie, but I don't necessarily, like, again, the film is such a psychedelic medium. It gave me the experience, like, watching movies when I was a kid gave me the experience that later on smoking pot with music gave me.
Yeah.
But I was totally sober as a kid watching those films. And they didn't even have to be great ones. A big screen that's just well done, and the story, like you say, the story is allowed to drive you, then it's going to be solid.
Yeah.
I want to go back because we were talking about Citizen Kane. Have you ever synced found an album that syncs really well with Citizen Kane?
I haven't. And to be honest with you, I pretty much... I mean, there's got to be something out there that works well. But I haven't done as much wide-ranging experimenting with this kind of thing. You could really circle like four albums and like six movies that I've really just focused on. Because really, that one... 7-8 months, well, actually like 12 month stretch where I was really doing this, it was really like being pulled towards the ultimate arrangement that I approached Alan with. But really what I would like to do is have conversations like this, and hopefully with some exposure in the Sync Book 2, is that over the years when people just do this and are attracted to or are compelled to combine things that they think would work, is to see these different combinations pop up. I'm sure someone will unlock Citizen Kane, Apocalypse Now. You can just think of the great.
Oh, movies. I've already got Apocalypse Now. I'm gonna do Apocalypse Now with Smile.
Oh, that's great. Pretty good, man.
It's gonna. I already know. Like, there's like. I have the same feeling about Lifehouse. Like, that is gonna, I know it's gonna sink. And it's gonna be fucking awesome. Yeah, I'm working on getting the best version of Smile available so that I can do that. But yeah, the sync already works. You don't even, in a way, if you know this medium, you already know that's like, you're laughing because you know that's gonna work.
It's like the John Carter thing. I didn't read any reviews, I didn't know the story. I just knew that Pink Floyd and that movie were going to fit like a glove. And the weirdest thing about John Carter, though, is when I went and watched it with The Wall, which was the second time I saw it, I started The Wall with In the Flesh, that's on the second album, which is the song I start the Kubrick thing that I do with 2001 The Shining. So I used my own starting point from The Wall. And if you start John Carter from when it opens from that song number 21 and allow it to cycle through, it's a perfect, perfect fit. And there are lyrics and things in the album. It just wouldn't make sense if you didn't start it from that song. And that's the one that really just kind of floored me, because I don't know, it was just the clarity with which I just understood these works of art, one that I'd been listening to and know like the back of my hand. The other one, I just knew in what spirit it was being created. And it's a masterpiece. It really is absolutely astounding how well that movie comes alive with that music. And it's a shame because the movie got panned. I didn't really hear too much...
And nobody said anything good about it.
No one left with, holy shit, at least that one part. Remember that one part? It didn't even get the holy shit, there was one part. It was just sort of, you liked it okay, or you just didn't see it. So what a waste of $200 million. I mean, it's gorgeous. Just for the visuals alone, it should have been seen in a movie theater.
Yeah. So.
And you know, really, there has to be a future for for people in movie studios to make money on this shit. That's what I'm interested to see, is when it evolves to that level, when people see it as an economic, you know, viability. That'll be kind of trippy.
So, Andras, do you have a thought for Citizen Kane? What album would go with it?
I don't know. I mean, initially, I've had a bunch of different ideas, but right now I'm leaning towards Bob Dylan.
Oh my God! You didn't just say that. You didn't just say that.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, that's. In my mind, I went, what might be long enough for, you know, for Citizen Kane? And I had this thought, my first thing that popped in my head was, I'm kind of looking at it, was the concert for Bangladesh. And then just because I was like looking at bigger albums. And then as soon as I thought that, I just imagined Bob Dylan, you know, Bob Dylan's section off there. And I was like, that would work so well. So yeah, I feel that very much. That was like an instinctive, just in the last 5 seconds before you said that. Yeah.
Not Olivia Newton-John.
Does she have a long form? Does she have any?
Well,
I think Xanadu, I think was a double album, wasn't it?
No, of course, it's a single record.
Yeah. But I know where you're going with that because, of course,
Xanadu.
Xanadu.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe just loop that one song. Who would need hot for that?
I would need something stronger for that.
I'm playing around with it, but I wish Blood on the Tracks was a double record. That's all. But maybe Blood on the Tracks and Desire. Like, that's the other thing of like what that I've been playing with is if an album finishes, I'll just go to the artist's next record and start their next, you know, and just continue. And there are some that, like, for me, there are some records that are really like version one and two of each other, like Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper's, and Magical Mystery Tour. Like, they could have been a double record.
Magical Mystery Tour is the bad sequel.
Oh, shut up. Magical Mystery Tour is a great, there's some of the best stuff the Beatles ever recorded is on that record.
Yeah.
Fool on the Hill is fucking awesome.
I don't like Fool on the Hill.
Oh, it's a great song.
Blue Jay Way, right?
Blue Jay Way I could do. Yo, give me any Harrison track, I could do it. That's why Revolver's so good. It's the only Beatles album with three Harrison songs. They didn't realize that's their great, you know, everyone's like, oh, Revolver's the best Beatles album. Yeah, why is that, motherfuckers?
I don't think it's because it has the...
Hey.
Three Harrison songs on it. What, is he has Taxman, and what are the other two? I don't think he has three songs on that. Maybe two, because the other two guys are writing the shit out of that record.
Yeah. Why can't I think of it? You got me stumped. I don't know.
There's some sitar on that album, isn't there?
No. You know, Harrison's not only sitar. Yo, man.
While his sitar slowly weeps.
Exactly.
Well, his sitar slowly sleeps. Anyway. What I was going to say, there was a thing.
Yeah, okay. Taxman, Love to You, and I Want to Tell You.
Oh, yeah. Those I Want to Tell You and Love to You are two really, they're really great ones. Yeah, those are better than, like, For No One and Good Day Sunshine. And Tomorrow Never Knows,
you know,
and I'm Only Sleeping, and
I'm
and
not
Your
saying
Bird Can
better.
Sing,
I'm not
and
say-
she said,
yo,
I'm just going to keep...
You motherfucker. It's not about being better. It's about a nice, you know, we're having a conversation about how the, you know, the artistry of one artist and the artistry of another sync together, right? So all I'm getting at is that, you know, it's like putting garlic in your tomato sauce, you know, it's like you're bringing out the flavor. So if, yeah, so, you know, your Lennon McCartney is your body, but I think that the Harrison brings it out. I think it's a really complimentary flavor, you know.
It's
so
like
it's not,
Tobin Sprout with Robert Pollard, you know, it's just that little edge, that little subtle difference. Both amazing songwriters, but they both improve each other's sound.
Yeah, I really just to say, I mean, I know you're just fucking with me. Andras and I have had many conversations about George Harrison, so I know he's just fucking with me. But ultimately, I just want to make that clear. I'm not saying he's better than, or his songs are better than those other songs. I'm saying that it really makes the album what it is.
Yes, because you're right. Because it's nice to have a breather from all that brilliance to like just have a couple of nice songs.
He's good, man. He's good.
But I want to jump to something, to an area where you have a much greater level of expertise about a certain artist than I do, Alan. Neil Young, he's got some big records. What's a good film to sync with Neil Young? What's the, and his big record is like, it's called Decade or what?
Decade is good. You know, it's like a basically a greatest hits.
Okay, so no, that doesn't he have a three record album, a three?
Yeah, I mean he has, you know, a huge discography, but he's also done. So he's done like film scores. He's also, I saw there's a really little known. It didn't do anything. I think it's called like Greenville or Greendale. Again, I don't even own the album, but he actually
Greendale. I think it is Greendale.
Yeah, Greendale, where he did he actually made a film. So he like made an album, made a film to go with it, and then I happened to see him in concert when he was debuting that. So he did the entire album start to finish with like a stage production. So it's, you know, he has actors on the stage, like while he's playing, there's like actors like basically pantomiming the action and stuff like that, while there's a screen behind them with clips from his film that he himself shot and like all this stuff. And it was pretty darn good. But then it was funny because it's going on. I was like, oh man, you know, this is cool, but I don't get to hear any Neil Young songs that I know. Is like, you know, he's debuting a brand new album, this whole production. It's like, well, that's really cool, but a little disappointing in that respect. So the concert ends and like half the people leave and I'm just staying. And I was like, no, fuck this, man. I was like, and there's got to be something else. He's got to come out, at least do an encore with some, you know, some classic stuff. So I see him at, this was in Atlantic City at like Trump's Taj Mahal, actually. And, Taj Mahal, there's a great musician you could sync with. But, so basically, so what happens is I'm in the fucking nosebleeds and everyone's leaving. So I just walk down and I end up sitting right behind Donald Trump and Neil Young's son. I'm in the second row. And then Neil Young and Crazy Horse come out and do an entire second concert. An entire second concert of all their, like, you know, greatest music. And
that's
I was like, motherfucker, it was so good. I could reach up and touch him. I was like, this is fucking crazy. So, sorry, just to say, I definitely think you could find stuff to sync with Neil Young. It definitely has that. I think there's something almost soundtracky about it. I did a lot of music for Where the Buffalo Roam, the Bill Murray as Hunter S. Thompson. He did music for that. So I think that would really lend itself. I'd be hard pressed to think of a good movie to sync it with.
I don't really want to use. I'm thinking that using soundtrack stuff is too easy.
I didn't mean use soundtracks. I meant that I think there's something about his music that does lend itself very naturally to being accompanied with film. That's really what I was trying to say.
Right. So, but I could just look this up, but doesn't he have like a three record album that he came out with in the 70s?
I thought was just Decade. That was the triple.
Okay, so Decade is the, okay, never mind. Okay, sorry.
What the one he did with Crazy Horse with Down by the River, that big one. Everybody knows this is nowhere.
Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere is the first Neil Young album I bought, and I listened to that till it fucking burned out. Yeah, that's a great album, but it's not very long.
You have
what is it, Cowgirl in the Sand, I think, is on that album, which is a long track. See, that's the thing. Like, Neil Young also has a few really long tracks. Like, just if you're trying to fill up a movie, I mean, things that you're not going to find on everything. But Cowgirl in the Sand is a lengthy song. There's a song he has called Words, which is like 11 minutes long. I mean, I might have a different way of going about this than you guys do. I guess in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't know why I'm going almost mixtape here, but yeah, we're talking decade, which is a century of greatest hits, but.
Adam, we don't need to go down this. We've been spent a long, too much time asking you questions about Neil Young that I could find out from a Google search. So let's go back to talking. Let's broaden the conversation again.
You trust Google to tell you what the good songs are?
I trust Wikipedia to tell me what what records, what discography someone has, and what songs are on them. That's what I've been using. And also, a lot of times, I'll just take a film and drop it in, and then drop in a record and see how close it gets.
Yeah, I think so. This is going back to the question. I mean, you guys are talking about the length of the album. I mean, that's sort of would be the, I think, the million-dollar question here is, are you trying to find, if a movie is 2 hours long, are you trying to find a two-hour block of music? I think these are just excellent questions to figure out. This is like, are you going for the longer, do you pull out your Quadrophenia? Do you pull out, All Things Must Pass?
That was the thing that someone suggested, which I thought was great, is to do Quadrophenia, but with all music that came out the year that it came out. So all that like late 70s, like the Jam, all the mod music that was coming out in England at that time, and no Who music. So like,
oh, I see
film,
what you're saying. Okay.
Do the film, you're saying Quadrophenia. The film Quadrophenia, yeah, which is a great film, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now, then do that.
I kind of, this idea of trying to make the entire 2 hour, 2.5 hour or 90 minute movie, trying to make the whole experience lucid by stringing together or connecting similar separate albums as the soundtrack is fine, but I almost take that into, and this is where I go off on my own little ego trip, is that it's like trying to sit down and read Finnegan's Wake from start to finish. You're just not going to do it. And it's not even meant to be read start to finish. But you just dip in at a certain point and some lucidity sort of arises and then it sort of disappears. And there's that ebb and flow of clarity and expression, and then it just bogs down and becomes jumbled again. But it always seems to return. There's a certain thread in there that will always pull you back. But it tests your patience. And that to me is one of the elements to this whole process that I seem to think is a foundation. And it's an integral part of it, is that it provides these areas where it's muddy and not so clear. But when it returns, when the sync returns, it announces itself with a higher volume then. Because if you read a section in a book and it doesn't make sense, and then you turn the page and then all of a sudden the previous page becomes clear because of one word or one sentence on that next page, it can tie together a lot of confusion and then you're off and you're in the book again. And that's sort of what happens when you take one album and you loop it throughout the entire film, is that you come upon a section that you've heard before and you think, oh, well, this is over. It's not going to really make sense anymore. But once 5 minutes passes, all of a sudden you're right back in it. And so there's something about that ebb and flow, that up and down, that, you know, clear and dark, that tests your patience, and it forces you to continue to work with the movie. You're not allowed to be passive like all those other people in the movie theater. You have to be sort of directing and writing and doing all the production work in your own head. It's not lasered in and done for you. And I think that's what McLuhan is getting at with how media brainwashes, is that if you just become a passive receptor, then you're just a remote control in reverse. You know, you've got to be more active with your media. You have to start to fill in the blanks, and you have to tie together all the loose threads. And that is sort of the magic of this thing, or what makes it sort of dangerous and makes it sort of, you know, something that is so against the mainstream culture of today. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, no, it totally does. And it makes me think that I want to experiment with that. Like, and out of this conversation, well, that's all, like, if I could, I'm going to try that out with Citizen Kane and Blood on the Tracks and see if.
And just loop the motherfucker.
Yeah, just loop it and see if it lines up.
Because it's weird how, what I found a lot with the Kubrick and the Floyd is when you loop an album three or four times throughout the entire story, is that the first run through, it has a very loose and very few kind of connections, but then it just increases. The depth of it is sort of on a exponential curve, you know, until all of a sudden you forget that where the movie and the album begin and end. It just fuses. And it's watching the fusion of the thing, of the experience, that I'm not sure if it's just in my own brain or it's really working between the two elements. And I think I have my own stance on it at this point, but I'm more interested in what other people's opinions of it are. There needs to be more sort of test subjects and bigger audiences. So I imagine, and let me point this back to you, is how many times at your bar have you been able to pull this off, Andres?
Oh, we haven't even done it yet. I'm pulling together the materials, and the plan is to start September 12th.
Oh, that's excellent.
Well, if I may, I've seen Bill's arrangement of what he calls the Kubrick Transformer, which is 2001 Space Odyssey / The Shining with Pink Floyd's The Wall. And I have to say, I told him when he first approached me, I said, I don't even really like The Wall. There's a few great tracks on there, but the album as a whole never really did it for me. I'm a Pink Floyd fan, but The Wall just was not my favorite. Actually, when I was really hard up for money a few years ago, one of the first things I sold was my copy of The Wall.
You're just waiting for that. You're just sitting there waiting to get broke enough to get rid of that piece of shit.
No. I didn't mean it like that. But
do you like the final cut?
Yeah.
I mean, is it diminishing returns? Like after Wish You Were Here and Animals, it just goes downhill for you?
No. I'm talking specifically the Wall. I love him. I don't know how to say, like, you know, again, this is a weird aesthetic thing, which is sort of off topic, but just to say, like, I don't think it's like being over ambitious. I don't know what it is, but it seems like there's a point in The Wall where it, instead of reaching a climax, it sort of drops off for me, which actually I think is interesting, is since Bill starts The Wall in the second half of the album, you actually get your true climax in that respect.
You do, because it ends with The Show Must Go On.
Yeah, so I really like his arrangement of that. Like, I have to say, just first off, what I was really going with this with The Wall was that Bill's film work as well as just rearranging the tracks of the wall really made me appreciate that album a lot more. So on the first compliments I'd like to pay it is that it really made me appreciate that music again in a different light. And I think that's, like I said, that's one of my issues. And it's funny, Quadrophenia, which is probably one of my favorite albums, every time I'd listened to it, I thought, and I love Reign Over Me is a great fucking song, but I always thought stylistically it should end with the last track on the first disc.
Really?
Yeah. And which is funny is that the Quadrophenia film actually does that.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So it should, so it's supposed to end with I've Had Enough? It's
yeah.
Wow.
So, and which was what I always felt listening to it. And the first time I saw the Quadrophenia movie, I was like, hey, someone got it. like someone got what I and how I envisioned it in my mind. And so that was really funny to me. The first time I saw the Quadrophenia film, I was like, oh, they ended it with the song that I thought it should have ended with. But anyway, so there is something to this sort of, to the arrangement of the tracks. But as someone who watched Bill's arrangement, my wife and I both watched, and we actually watched it sober, just because I was trying to pay attention to, this was before you had given me an edited version, and I was still, like, so I'm piecing it together myself, and I had to, sort of monitor, I had a very loosely rigged arrangement here that I had to monitor. So, like, all right, I'm just going to stay sober and sort of pay attention to, how that has to be and whatever. And also just to get that sense of it. I was like, I could always watch it again, stoned or whatever, but I just want to get the initial sense of it. And so we watched it, and I would say about 20 minutes in, 25 minutes in, at some point, something happened, and I went to my wife, oh, that's crazy. Did you see how that synced with that? And she goes, oh, yeah. She's like, I actually forgot these were separate. It wasn't supposed to be like this. Like, even though these were, things you'd seen a million times, when Space Odyssey and The Shining, the fact that you really were so familiar with it that you could so quickly get sucked into the marriage of these things that you actually forget it wasn't, that she would say, I forgot it wasn't supposed to be like this. This music wasn't always with this film. It's just really like a testament, and I hope a compliment that can be paid to what you found.